Grade 1 Conference, Lecture 46, Storytelling, Part 9. Clearly, storytelling is an important part of our work, and I'm very happy to have the time in an online conference, which I would never be given in a live conference because there are so many other things to take up, that I can really share with you the significance of the art of storytelling as such, and particularly our work in grade one with fairy tales and other stories as well. So let's look at what I term the archetypes in these stories. My parents in first grade were very sweet and created a little puppet theater for me. And we had finger puppets. I shouldn't say finger puppets, hand puppets, actually. And they created a king, a queen, a prince, and a princess. And the prince even had wire-rimmed glasses, like I had. I was very moved by that. And we had a witch and a wizard and maybe a dragon or something like that. But basically, you know, there you've got it. They gave me, all I needed was about six characters, and we could use that every Friday for reviewing many of our stories after we had done just purely oral review. And I could just mention that the presence of a hand puppet in the class, especially for children who may be a little bit on the Asperger side, or ADHD side, children who have a hard time just standing up in front of the class and reviewing something because either they get too silly or they get too silent, put those puppets on their hands and let them go into below where they're not seen or where they're not going to be the center of attention. The puppet will be very powerful. So there we have it, just a few archetypal figures. And I'm going to try to explain a little bit about these figures, but you know, I don't want to kind of embalm them either. And I want to say that in every story, an archetypal figure may play a slightly different role. Sometimes even will play a counterintuitive role, opposite to what you would expect. But just to give us some sort of little legend as we enter into the map of the dark wood of the fairy tale. So we have the, you know, Fab Four, the basic family, the king, the queen, the prince, the princess. The prince and princess won't necessarily come from the same family. In fact, usually they don't, and that makes for the possibility of them falling in love with each other and creating a new family of their own. But nonetheless, the four of them will be there, sort of sharing the stage. The king often, for the most part, in general, so with each of these, every time I say the king represents or the queen represents, please keep all those qualifiers in mind. The king is the physical body. He is, as it were, that which rules in the world. The physical, material world, and over which he has control, and he often is extremely powerful and quite autonomous. It's not like very many others are telling him what to do. And it's not surprising, then, that in many stories, the king is ill or the king is dying. And the story revolves around trying to heal the king or trying to restore the dead king to life or trying to deal with the possibility that he will not live and will there be a prince found who will be able to assume, you know, the reins of that throne. So the king, the queen. Very often the queen has already died. The queen is often a departed presence. We could say that she is very much connected to the etheric body. Now hold on, you're going to say, go ahead and say it. You said she's dead, and the etheric body you've been telling us is life, life, life. What's going on here? Yes, I've also told you that at this age, at age 7, the child's etheric umbilical cord, which connects the child's etheric body and etheric forces to that of the mother, gets cut. And we could say that a part of the mother, and certainly an important part of the child's direct connection to the mother, dies. That there is a kind of dying away. It's just like the placenta is expelled from the mother's body and buried or whatever one does with that. The same thing with the umbilical cord, the etheric umbilical cord. It is now dead substance. So there is a kind of dying of one aspect of the etheric forces. And the dying queen or the dead queen often represents this. And who is there in her place? And I could say very often there's a fifth figure here, something of an interloper. We have the new queen, who more often than not, alas, is wicked, is secretly a witch, or at least is so jealous of someone or other, or so antipathetical to this one or that one, or so nervous that her power will be taken away from her, that she then deceives the king, enchants the king, gets the king to just sort of relinquish his real power, and she takes over and works in a way to actually destroy the child because it's somebody else's child. She may have her own child whom she is carefully guarding and looking after and wants to succeed, and meanwhile, she's going to have to destroy the child of another to do that. So here already it gets a little bit complicated. What body is this queen representing? We could say that she is in the realm where the astral body becomes too active in the human being. So this is the astral body, but not healthy astrality. This is where the astral body comes too soon, where the etheric forces are too weak, or have, we could say, faded away like the good queen. And this astral body is able to run roughshod over them. It's catabolic in nature. It's destructive. It wants to kill. It must kill. That's its whole task. It destroys the food that we eat. In a certain way, we could say, it makes that food substance kind of poisonous. And then our etheric forces must rise up and heal us. And in that way, we digest. You know, we have all of these. I've spoken of the elementals in our digestive system and, you know, the kind of bacteria that live there that, if released, run rampant in our body and kill us. So this is the wicked stepmother. She's kind of a force of nature. She's the lower astrality that certainly must exist because not everything can be built up all the time, but that also needs to be brought into line, needs to be tamed, needs in one way or another to be harmonized or expunged. Then we have the prince and the princess. And here we have much greater fluidity of identity. We could say that the prince and the princess, depending on the story and depending on the circumstances, they are emblematic of, they are symbolic of the higher astral body and the higher ego. And they must be brought together in one way or another, and they're, as I said, not always of the same family, of course, so that this perhaps future marriage can occur, so that that which is now going to meet the etheric and physical forces is higher and purer, so that what has fallen into matter can be redeemed in one way or another. So that's sort of the basic players. Those are the basic players in the story. And generally where a wicked witch or a wizard who is not positive, who's not working with good forces, where they appear, this usually is symbolic of the lower astral forces and how they just, in a way, take over and are very, very difficult to overcome and defeat. Now, that's one set of archetypes. And here's another, which will take us into deeper waters, and I'm going to be working now more strongly, let's say, from some of Steiner's more esoteric writings. And once again, as with so much here, if you're not that interested, you could stop right now. You probably have plenty to work with. But if you want to go a little bit more deeply, as I said, that you're going to hear sometimes, oh, these fairy tales, they go all the way back to ancient Atlantis. They're the oldest stories, and you can't mess around with them. And my point was, well, yes, some of them. And I think that some of the stories that I've shared with you in my top 20 are stories that go back there, and that, in a way, even go back further than that. So Steiner tells us that in the very earliest stages of Earth evolution, when human beings first began to appear on the Earth, this was at a time that he describes as Lemuria. And he said that the quality of Lemuria, the quality of earthly life at that time, was very fiery, that volcanoes occurred all the time, that forces of fire kept everything, including the Earth's atmosphere, which was very liquefied at that time, very viscous, it kept everything sort of at a boiling point, that Lemuria just was always, in a stage of boiling. And as it cooled down, as the meteorological and geological processes began to stabilize and settle down, then the most primitive forms of human culture arose. And these forms arose under the leadership of women. They were all matriarchal, that the sexes had separated. There were many men, fewer women on the earth, and the women were really the leaders. And they would, through their speech and something like speech song, they would lead men in movement and dance and a kind of ritual quality. And this was the very beginning of what we could call tribal civilization in a way. And then all of this disappeared because it got very decadent, and certain human beings, among them these women, got control of these fire forces and began to use them destructively. And finally, all of Lemuria just went up in a cataclysm of earthquakes and volcanoes and fires, leading to the next phase, better known, and the one that you may have cited to you, Atlantis. And Atlantis was a watery world. Here the atmosphere was full of mist and fog, and people actually never even saw the sun. It was, however, also, with all that water, a culture very strongly imbued with etheric forces. And again, in the initiation centers, individuals of high moral calling were allowed to control these watery forces. And with this, they could sort of defy gravity. They could use plant power forces to grow gigantic forests overnight if they needed that, or if they needed to, grow food. They could plant a seed, and the next day it would be huge. They also were able to create devices using, again, these anti-gravitational forces in plants to move over water very quickly, to move in the air, to fly through the air. And Steiner has said their technology was astonishing. And what we regard today as our remarkable technology is child's play compared to that. That there was a kind of magical quality to it all. But there again, certain individuals got hold of these watery forces and did not know how to use them in a positive and disciplined way. And that led, of course, to the legendary Atlantean flood, which buried Atlantis in the way Lemuria had been destroyed by fire. So these are two phases of Earth evolution that existed in the past, but as is true of anything that's appeared on the Earth, there's always a little bit of a residue. And the closer it is to our time, the more the residue is there, we could say. Something of it still lives on, but because it is no longer in harmony with our time, it no longer is correct for it to be there. It's not going to have a positive salutary effect. So think of how often in fairy tales, the hero or heroine finds him or herself in a dark wood, and there's a light in the distance. They go towards the light. There's a house, and there is a woman in that house. And what is she doing? She's cooking. She's cooking up a storm, quite literally, in a big cauldron. And maybe we learn of the various things that she's tossing in there. We even get this in Shakespeare, in Macbeth, the Weird Sisters. We see this way back then. Pre-fairy tale, we might say, pre-Grimm's anyway. So she's throwing in, we could say, everything. The whole world is getting thrown in this cauldron. She's trying, or she has, recreated a kind of little Lemuria in this house, and it's not good, because very likely she's missing a very important ingredient who just happens to have walked in the door, and the rest of their time together is going to be spent seeing, you know, who gets cooked and who's doing the cooking. So there you have, and I'd say another Lemurian quality is where you come across a swamp. Suddenly there's a swampy place with quicksand or, you know, just a very strange feeling about it. You see this later, you'll see this in grade 6 in the Arthurian stories. And who's often living there? This would be a dragon. And the dragon does what? Breathes fire. And the dragon is, again, like what's in the cauldron, a mixture of all kinds of kingdoms of nature. He's got scales like a fish or a reptile. He's, you know, maybe has wings like a bird. He has the teeth of a lion or much larger. So here again, we could say that in many situations, the witch, who often is cooking up something, creating a magic potion, mixing up a poison, and the dragon with the fire of his nature. These are representatives of the Lemurian age, and they can't do good. It's very hard to simply redeem these creatures, much as we would like to. They may have to be really completely extirpated and destroyed. And then what about Atlantis? I did not mention that Atlantis, of course, was contrary to Lemuria in every way, water instead of fire and so on. It also was a culture of male dominance. So we had the oracles, who were the great initiates, all men who led Atlantean culture. Women did not play a very important role in that culture. So when we come upon a figure who, a male figure, like a wizard, who has mysterious, almost magical powers, who can perhaps turn himself into a bird and fly around at night, who can create a ship that moves rapidly across the water, or who is behind the scenes pulling the strings, so that the prince finds himself in these situations as well. And, you know, it's nothing in a fairy tale, no big deal for a bird to say, climb on my back and I will take you where you need to go. You see this mobility in space, this ease of defying gravity and moving around very quickly. These are Atlantean capacities that are brought. But very rarely in the classic fairy tale is this bird invited back home with the prince, or does the prince bring back the boat that can go anywhere to amuse his friends and family? No, this is all left behind. It's needed for that prince or princess to be able to go through their trials and tribulations and fulfill the tasks that have been laid upon them. But it's nothing that in the end remains with them. They don't need it anymore because they have taken hold of those Atlantean forces. So the Atlantean forces are not necessarily destroyed, though wizards often will go the way of witches, but very often they're used and then they're discarded because Atlantis is a little bit closer to the time of the fairy tales being written. Those forces are not inherently so destructive as of yet. So there you see sort of the two sides of what's presented as evil, or at least dangerous to be avoided, and yet sometimes one can't get away from it, one has to go right through it, and re-experience the part of one's own being that still lives in Lemuria that must be expelled. Re-experience the part of one's own being that still lives in Atlantis and must be transformed. And to find then in our time not just a culture in which the woman dominates, not just a culture in which the male dominates, but a culture in which the prince and princess are united, in which we have a harmonization of the forces of male and female. There are other archetypes, there are other ways of explaining these, and I do not claim that this is at all exhaustive, but I hope that it just acts as a stimulant for you to, you know, as you read the stories, to think about these figures for yourself.